my God, can you guys hear that? Well, that is a great introduction to the podcast today.
You're such a punk.
No, nothing. The cat's just being very noisy. Hello, and welcome back to Decolonize Everything Podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Mendoza, and I'm a PhD student now. I think the last podcast I recorded, I was in the midst of applications for the PhD. It was so intense. It was all a blur. A really, really rough fall and winter, but I'm really grateful to be here. I'm still at Harvard. And there's a lot going on. And to be completely honest, I'm mostly reading these days, which apparently is my job. I'll go back to teaching in a couple years, but it's all about research and a few research jobs that I'm doing on the side. And it's tricky. It's such a different type of doing that I'm used to. I'm used to working many jobs. I'm used to being kind of all over different community groups or organizing or whatever. At the advice of many good advisors and friends, people who I feel accountable to and people who I trust, I'm supposed to be just reading, mostly reading. Of course, I'll be writing, going to conferences, all of those beautiful things, talking and being in discussion with the folks around me. But my main job is to learn. And I think that's part of why it's so weird to produce podcasts, or even papers, to be honest, but especially podcasts, because they're public. My papers, you know, they go to maybe one or two people. even if they get published, you know, it's a small crowd. But that's the gift of this podcast for me, is that I get to practice articulating, and I do that with humility to the best of my ability. So consider all of this just drafts submitted to all of you, my listeners, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say. So this podcast serves a few different purposes. Of course, here it is on Decolonize Everything Podcast. It's a way of sharing some of the things I've been thinking about, both in the classroom and outside the classroom. And this particular episode is actually many years in the making in terms of my life experience, because many of the stories in this podcast actually go all the way back to pre-pandemic, so long ago, I know. But it begins, in many ways, with adopting a dog named Miko. And the story continues into our move to Cambridge, Massachusetts, moving out of an RV into an apartment, living through pandemic winter, and I'll leave the details for later. But there's another part that I want to share, which is that our family, which was once me and Michael and Miko and Rumi and a hedgehog named Francie, has changed a lot during those years, and you'll hear about some of that in the episode. The latest is that Michael and I are no longer together. So while I stayed near campus and I get to live with Rumi, Michael and Miko moved not too far away. And it's been hard to recalibrate and adjust, and so sharing this and articulating these experiences from the last years is also a part of working through those different feelings and experiences, of closing some spiritual relational loops. So this episode is dedicated to you, Michael and Miko, because they've been such good family to me, and I've learned so much in those relationships. Around the second half of this episode, I focus more on analysis, in kind of a broad sense of the term. I bring in examples outside of my own experience that help me understand and engage with the broader question of how to relate with animals who are dangerous, who are dying, and more broadly on the spectrum, other. And that's my chance to share some of the voices that I've been reading, the different theorists, and the different historical figures that are reconfiguring my own ethics of relationship. So with that little introduction piece of context, I also want to give a content warning. Because the first half of this episode is mostly storytelling from my personal life, and it includes some painful moments. I talk explicitly about hard experiences I've had with Miko, and also about death of animals. And while I try to reframe and work with the different experiences of animal death, of what has been experienced as dangerous or scary, I just want to give you a heads up. And the last thing I want to say before moving into the episode is that I'm publishing this podcast in early November, and it has been a really intense, horrific month of watching unfolding genocide and suffering in Gaza. I admit that I've had to educate myself on occupation and suffering. I'm grateful for friends like Vic Hogg and others who have taken time to share their experiences and their insights. I'm grateful for those on social media who are putting out voices of folks who are most affected. And in the spirit of humility, I don't really have much more to say besides that I too have been weeping. I too have been trying to educate myself. I too have been having conversations that are really hard. And I'm committed to standing in solidarity with Palestinians. This podcast, Decolonize Everything, exists because more and more I see that colonialism was not a certain period. Colonialism didn't go away. And we have to continue to work through the kind of ideas that we've internalized, the ways that we've failed one another with our ethnic-centric, whitewashed understandings of the world. So that's my commitment, not only to be educated and to be aware, because that's bare minimum, but to continue to speak out, to continue to share, to donate, to look for ways of offering practical care, whether that's going to marches, calling Congress, or participating in networks and solidarity. I know it's overwhelming. I've been crying in front of my phone almost every night. I felt the weight on my chest and my shoulders. I'm distracted from my school, and I'm confused by the fact that, as always, our United States capitalist cities continue moving as though nothing's happening. So thank you to all of you who are stopping. And with that very incomplete pause, I will also light some cedar for us and give this smoke and these prayers and these commitments our ancestral love and knowledge on behalf of those who are being displaced, who are being murdered, whose voices are not being heard, whose lives are being devalued. And I'm offering this smoke not as a way of purifying anything at this moment, instead as a point of connection to the unseen world, to the spirits, to our ancestors, and to that energetic power that moves between all of us, even through our screens. We'll just take a moment to breathe into that, to sing into that, to cry and scream into that reality. let's dive in with a personal story. I have a scar to prove it. I was attacked that night by my adopted dog, about 4 years old and 48 pounds. He has a square pit bull head and a strong chest and a tricolor beagle body. He came from the shelter with the name Miko on his papers, and he didn't care for any of the alternatives. His eyes are wide and round. I think he looks concerned whenever they aren't squeezed shut for sleeping. He has triangle-shaped ears which move up and back and side to side, communicating ever-shifting awareness. And after studying late on a winter night, I saw his big eyes and his strong chest from a horrifying angle. I had startled him during his deep sleep, and he took me to the floor. And I think he could have killed me. How we got there is another story. Suffice it to say, at that point in time, he had already drawn blood from one goat, two dogs, and a few humans. That being my former boss's goat, which makes it much worse. One of my best friend's senior German Shepherd dogs, who I love dearly. And my younger sister and the back of her leg when she came to visit me. Oh God, I feel terrible just talking about that and mentioning it. I feel it in my body. And we had welcomed Miko, desiring to explore what that type of companionship would mean. But within months of having him here with us, we knew it was going to be a long journey ahead. But I didn't know his fearful reactivity could be directed at us, too. I thought he was defending me from others. Surely blood could be drawn on my behalf. But of course, that's a classic case of exceptionalism, bolstered by signs of steady trust building and occasional snuggles. To back it up a little, when I first saw Miko listed for adoption, he was labeled as reserved, shy, and calm. And there's no doubt that he managed those attributes while caged and transferred between multiple animal shelters for almost a year. But now, his big, dormant emotions were beginning to emerge, or rather, explode. After the bite, Miko and I kept our distance for quite a while. It was awkward, at best, to be locked down together during online school in a pandemic winter. A few months afterward, Michael and I took Miko to a veterinarian behavioralist. She pulled out a chart. It was essentially the different levels of bites. And there's only one step between the kind that I received and the one that reads, quote, victim dead. She recommended we seriously consider behavioral euthanasia. Another trainer experienced with reactive dogs said, I'm sorry he's no longer rehomable. Because of bite history and potential for future aggression, there's really no good place for dogs like Miko to go. This bite is a type of event that blurs time and muddies my memories. So I'm still unsure of the time frame, but I knew it was days or weeks after another dear one had died. That dear one, a family member, was a hedgehog. She easily fit into my two cupped hands, just under 300 grams of a soft white belly and salt and pepper colored spines on her back. I jokingly refer to her as a gateway animal because she inspired me to open my heart, to imagine relationships beyond the human. And ultimately, we brought home a rescue cat named Rumi, and later Miko. That means, at one point, that Michael, Miko, Francie, Rumi, and I all shared a 25-foot RV. And beyond the RV, there were spiders and sparrows, rabbits, owls, grasshoppers, and other creatures of the ex-urban Denver ecosystem. Loving Franzie was pivotal for rethinking the anthropocentric assumptions I'd adopted over the course of my life. After a short 4 years together, and a long trek from Colorado to Cambridge, I found a growth in Franzie's jaw. It was cancer, and there was nothing that we could do. So by early March 2021, she was bleeding from one eye. The tumor kept growing, and she kept shrinking. I was witnessing for months what was expected to only last weeks, and I wasn't sure if that was a good thing. Her heated home was set up next to my desk, where I supplied food, water, medicine, and affection as she desired between Zoom calls and school and work. Finally, one morning, after wiping the blood and syringing pain medicine into her swollen mouth, I tried to release my romanticized notions of a so-called natural death. I asked for her permission, and I called the veterinarian. And in that way, Michael and I aided her transition. Of course, I think about how much anxiety Miko must have felt in those months. I know it was heavy for him too. My first semester of grad school, COVID-19, endless Zoom calls after moving to a new city, and a dying animal relative that he certainly could smell. Our fears and concerns traveled like electric currents between us. And it should go without saying that these afflictions, like any human affliction, they're interlaced with experiences of deep love, profound beauty, and playful patterns. And yet in our relational struggles, these animals invited me to cross a threshold into a new layer of kinship. After all, the times we also played the prescribed roles of pet or owner were not really transformative. It was through complications, conflict, care, and negotiation that I began to ask, how can I be a good relative to dangerous and dying beings? In the years following these precarious and precious encounters with that dangerous dog and the dead hedgehog, I have unraveled and rearranged my mind and heart. My approach to decolonial theories, indigenous philosophies, religious studies have been challenged again and again to contend with the concrete realities of relationships with other than human beings. This was the waking up and returning to the fullness of human-animal, human-plant, human-spirit interactions, and certainly all the combinations beyond my imagination. I remember in the early era of text messages when the acronym DTR started to float around. Define the relationship. And wow, that makes me sound like a true millennial. The message usually came in the form of an imperative from one unsatisfied party. In the early 2000s, we messaged each other and looked to Facebook, longing for clear-cut, unambiguous boxes to check. While societal standards for human relationships have noticeably shifted during my lifetime, I wonder how our DTR urge informs interspecies connections. We want to be clear about what we're getting into and what we have or don't have. But when Franzie, Rumi, and Miko came to live in the RV, I found myself struggling with the terminology available to me. I'm not their mother, I would say, as I scooped their poop and filled their water bowls. And with Miko, I was especially at a loss. If the word pet truly comes from the Scottish Gaelic term meaning tame animal, that was off the table for Miko. Am I an owner? God, no. I shudder at the connotation, drenched in Christian frameworks of human domination over animal and the earth. And while massive markets have been built to enforce that type of relationship, neither Miko nor I were attracted to the idea. Though I will confess, in the days following the bite, I frantically researched all the mechanisms with which humans, quote-unquote, break or deal with animals like Miko. It became clear to me that collectively, we aren't that progressive, non-violent, animal-lover community that we profess to be. The power dynamic is inescapable. I hold the leash, I control the flow of kibble, and I do have a strange legal status that's unavailable to Miko. I know that friendship across power differentials is possible, but in my years of working across human boundaries of class, gender, and race, I know it's easier said than done. Social media plays its role in portraying this paradisical world where dogs and deer lie together in peace. I'll share a link in the episode notes, but I think you know what I mean. But, alas, Miko and Rumi could not cohabitate. I lived in an RV with a dog and a cat who could not be together. Aren't rescued animals supposed to exude gratitude to us humans for saving them? Well, it turns out it's more complicated than Instagram leads us to believe. And that savior mentality is a hard one to shake. All the words I could find to define this relationship appeared as band-aids on the gaping wound of contemporary human-animal conflict and connection. So the question remains open. Who are we to each other? And whatever this is, how do we do it well? Dog trainer laughed. The good thing about squirrels is that dogs can never catch them. Miko and I looked at each other. He definitely knows the word squirrel, but he impressively looked to me for a treat rather than stiffening his tail for the hunt. I admitted to the trainer that Miko had in fact already killed 2 squirrels in the first few months that we'd shared. Once we got to Cambridge, he was working on self-constraint on another level of squirrel-filled parks. I kind of think it's like my experience in the ice cream aisle at Market Basket. It helps that Miko stays on a leash and seems interested in the alternative to squirrel meat, which is highly processed, corn-based, affordable dog food. Another fall day in Cambridge, we were negotiating my desire to jog and his desire to sniff. Before I knew what was happening, he lunged into a bush and emerged with a squirrel in his mouth. I instinctively tugged the leash and the squirrel managed to get loose of his jaws, but the damage was done and there was blood. I gave Miko hot dogs to redirect his focus and I ran him home. We were both amped up and his lips were chattering and my hands were shaking. I wiped the blood from his face and I gave him peanut butter in the room while I caught my breath. I then walked back to the scene, sullen. Children were on the basketball court near the squirrel's now dead body. And somehow nobody seemed to notice or care. I had no handbook for this, no experience, and Google's advice to call animal control was uninspiring at best. I had an impulse to care for this body, particularly thinking about a transitioning soul. The squirrel's body resembled Francie's, the hedgehog, with sharp nails and nimble paws and whiskers protruding from a once energetic nose. Not wanting to wrap compostable flesh in plastic or add this body to a landfill, I tried to dig a hole with my bare hands to bury the squirrel. I'll admit that tears were falling as I covered this limp body with leaves and twigs. It was a mix of feelings, but I know I felt guilty, responsible for the suffering of another being. But at the same time, that shame seemed like a social construct. Was Miko's impulse to hunt really that wicked? As long as this body wasn't poisoned or diseased, I hoped that someone would come eat and enjoy. A hawk, a fox, or the earth consuming this being. I reflected on these ideas while watching a hawk eat a squirrel near Cambridge Public Library. I could smell the blood and hear the bones breaking. Since Miko wasn't with me, I had the opportunity to become spellbound by the scene. I told the hawk I would keep a respectful distance, only breaking my own trance to notice all the humans walking below the hawk without even noticing. I thought about how carefully he seemed to be picking apart the squirrel body, although I'm sure through many, many generations of consumption, he's learned quite the process. I did imagine he was savoring and devouring in a respectful manner in some sort of ritual, and I wondered what a mealtime ceremony the hawk practiced. I don't know. I don't know what that means, but I'm curious about it. Especially as I looked down at my plastic-wrapped protein bar and considered how distant my food felt, how hard it was for me to sense any of these energies or souls moving from processed grains into my gut. I told the hawk, I'm not better than you, which certainly he already knew. So I sat as a student, observing until the sun went down. I considered the squirrel who'd become food. And I wasn't sorry for the flesh, because I trust that that entity is not gone, but is now the recycled energy released from one body into another. To me, this way of killing, dying, and eating was satisfying. So I consider myself trained by the Cambridge Hawks, and by Miko. And I find human ritual specialists who help move between natures, not only after death, in order to help me be a good human relative. In the domination over dogs model, we act as though the growl itself is naughty, and we seek to subdue that undesirable behavior. Of course, rarely looking back at our own behavior, about which the dog is telling us, hey, this is undesirable. For better or for worse, Miko is physically stronger than me, which means I don't have much of a choice but to respect his space, and to trust that he doesn't want to hurt me. He doesn't growl often any longer, but when he does, it does affect me deeply. Both before and after the bite, those growls produce a physiological reaction, and they're supposed to. I back up, I reconfigure my body in relation to his, and oftentimes I leave the room to breathe. I have taken it personally and emotionally, a product of my own wounds. But over time, when Miko would growl, I practice saying, thank you. Thank you for telling me that I made you uncomfortable. I don't punish the growl, and I try not to punish myself for being growled at. And I mention this because as I'm inspired by beautiful ideas of moving energies and expansive personhood, I do recognize the power of boundaries, because even Miko's multiplicity of self, it includes tender spaces. The boundlessness of our souls means we get to work with one another to cultivate connections across our differences. And one of my guides in this inquiry has been Alexis Pauline Gums, who calls herself a queer black troublemaker and black feminist love evangelist and an aspirational cousin to all sentient beings. In her book, Undrowned, she takes on this role of an apprentice to marine animals, and she writes to them using her first and second pronouns. And apprentice is a good word. I've been known to search for teachers, and there was one sitting right in front of me. He's a good teacher, and I'm learning to be a better student. He commands respect, and yet also sits for treats, so we take turns training. Gums reports that the Indo-Pacific bottlenose dolphins live among sharks, and they wear bite marks on their backs. And Gums praises the bold marine mammals for living among predators. My own scar, not far from my heart, reminds me of my vulnerability. And it reminds me of Miko's too. Both of us can be defined by our scars. On the topic of dolphin scars and ours, Gums writes, quote, sometimes those of us with similar vulnerabilities are the ones who scar each other. And yet, what has been done, though still not over, is not the end. And your scars are not all I know about you. And my scars are not all I want you to know. Within that, I know Francie beyond her bleeding eye, and I know she knows me beyond my feeble attempts to meet her needs as her physical body gave way. And I tell Miko and myself that what has been done is not the end. So defining these relationships includes imagination, dreaming of what could be. On a good day, Rumi, the strikingly independent cat in my home, will willingly sit on my lap. And it's a great privilege, similar to when Francie would uncurl and lower her spines. Miko consents to kisses on his forehead and opens his body towards me for belly rubs. And while I do not want interspecies relationships to depend on the type of intimacies that fill my human vision of love, I admit that in those moments, I flirt with the belief that there's really no separation between them and me. Alexis Pauline Gumbs models a way of consistently confronting, quote, colonial, racist, sexist, hetero, patriarchalizing, capitalist constructs, unquote, with her loving messages with, for, and from sharks, whales, harbor seals, and ancestors. She knows there's emergent strategies and survival at the margins, and it provides an opening and a gap for new ways of feeling and fostering relationships. Which brings me back to the growl. Because Alexis Pauline Gumbs also says that the southern four-toothed whale is often called shy by scientists, like Miko was in the shelter. And she wonders if this shyness is stealth, if it's an avoidance, if it's a boundary against being colonized. So Gumbs says to the whales, and I repeat to Miko, I love you, and I celebrate your right to evade and avoid me. I respect you as so much bigger than my own understanding. And Gumbs turns back to herself, writing, and me too. I don't have to be available to be eligible for my own breath. I do not have to be measurable in a market. I do not have to be visible to be viable on my path. So I do respect Miko's boundaries and learn from them to the best of my ability. I learn to ask permission to pet his belly. In fact, Michael first caught on to this. And we have collaboratively constructed a language of consent. Miko shows me his neck, that vulnerable position, and I brush it. I ask him, do you want more? And he'll paw me with his approval. When he struggles with a ball that gets stuck under the dresser or the couch, I've learned not to assume that he wants me involved. And so I ask him, do you need help? And I practice discerning the answer. And usually in these cases, he'll try his best to wait while I do the retrieving for once. Miko may have many selves who are deeply wounded and unwell, but we found sustaining ways to stay alive in our bodies during this time. And it was healing. So in each of these scenes, these stories, these moments that I've shared so far, more than anything in these moments, I realized I didn't quite know what ground to stand on. I wasn't sure what sort of moral compass or worldview or perspective to hold on to. And so many of the ones that I'd been familiar with before were failing me, which is why I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to read and think with so many different people across so many different times and spaces. And I want to be clear that this is not the only way, nor the best way, I think, to learn or to relate. In fact, oftentimes, sometimes our learning, our reading, our studying pulls us out of these relationships and out of our bodies and our experiences and our encounters. And so I want to preface any sort of analysis by saying that I don't necessarily see this as a process of making sense or making meaning, although that's always an impulse and always a kind of natural desire that we have. Rather, I think about this as continuing the storytelling, but looking to examples that are outside of my immediate reach. So I'll be moving through different theories or iterations of relationships with animals, as I attempted to do with Alexis Pauline Gumbs and her relationships with animals. I'll also bring in examples of working with spirits, and spirits who move in through the bodies of other beings, be it animal or plant. And, as I will mention, there's an important place for ritual specialists, for elders, for knowledge keepers, for those who can serve as guides, as healers. It looks different in different communities, traditions, and landscapes. But broadly speaking, which is dangerous, but I'll do it anyways, there are humans who have the capacity, be it through training or through a natural gift, a combination of both or something else entirely, who move between different spaces, different levels of existence, through the seen and unseen, tangible and intangible, different types of powers and entities and beings. And when they're willing, we'll often receive instructions in rituals, in practices, whether that be burning incense or making an offering, providing a sacrifice, consuming or fasting, building habits, engaging in ceremony and ritual in order to participate in the world around us, our ecosystem, with our ancestors, our deities, with the ghosts, with the ground. So on that note, we shall dive into the books. And this will be a little bit more of me riffing than reading, because it's an attempt to take what I've been reading, process it, and rephrase it, share it. And also, I'm sorry for my pronunciations, I'm sure they're horrific, but I will be putting links. There will be links in the episode notes so that you can follow along. Check out these different threads and read for yourself. Okay, first, perspectivism. This is a really important concept for me, and learning it mostly in conversation with Michael Pewitt, reading Eduardo Viveros de Castro, and some of his conversation partners. Both the academic conversation partners, people who are responding to his work, but more importantly, the indigenous people of the Amazon with whom he did his research. What I really appreciate about his work is that he is taking seriously the philosophy, the metaphysics, the deep thinking and engaging with the cosmos. These aren't thoughtless actions, they're deeply rooted. What Mexican historian Alfredo López Austin calls a hard nucleus. And one of those for the Arahuete in the Amazon is what Viveros de Castro calls perspectivism. Ultimately, what this means is that the world is full of beings, of souls, of persons who have perspectives. And I mean perspectives in the sense that the way you or I look out at the world from inside our bodies. In a human body, I look out into the world and I articulate what I'm seeing. I call things different names, but ultimately most of what I'm looking at is not human. I'm human. There's other humans, but everything else falls into different categories. And in this Amazonian metaphysics, there's an understanding that for the other beings, take, for example, the jaguar, the jaguar also has the same way of seeing the world, meaning from his body, from their body, they look out into the world and they see other than humans. They are the human. So I look at Miko, I call him a dog, I'm the human. But he thinks of himself as a human and looks at me as something else. And the key idea is that we're seeing, we're looking out into the world in a similar way, but we're not necessarily seeing the same things. The classic example that Viveros de Castro gives is our experience of seeing blood, whereas for the jaguar, that blood is actually their beer, to put it in terms that we as humans understand. I see blood, they see beer. I see blood, Miko sees some delicious syrup. His other example is that a human sees a mud puddle, but that mud puddle to the animals of the Amazon, like the tapir or the peccary, is a grand ceremonial house where they get to do a beautiful ritual. In another article that we read for this class, also engaging with the Amazon, but more through the idea of sound, Rafael José de Meneses Bastos writes about the peccary playing coconuts as music. We see them pushing it around, but they're not eating it. So it's not necessarily a function as we often assume for animals, but rather they're making music. And like Viveros de Castro's noticing of perspectivism and that visual world as being so important, Meneses Bastos also contributes another idea of the South American lowlands, articulating how sound is socialized, hearing is socialized. And he gives an example of being in a canoe, and Aweka, who's with him, tells him that the fish are singing, but he can't hear it. And like many academics, he assumes that, you know, there's some sort of hallucination, there's some sort of belief or materialization of something that's not actually there. But it turns out Western science could actually start to articulate acoustic behavior. So Meneses Bastos started to rethink his own way of hearing the world. So thinking about these two Brazilian anthropologists, and more importantly, the communities they're writing about, we can see that there are alternative ways of simply existing, of being, and of relating. There's different assumptions about how the world works. The animals communicate, they talk, they sing, they participate in rituals, they have their own cosmos, their own practices. In another example, articulating ideas of death, Viveros de Castro talks about how grandparents who pass, their souls moves into other bodies, populating the world around us. It's a sort of reincarnation in the sense that grandmother's body no longer holds her. But the Arawete, for example, see that their grandmother's spirit goes into the body of the white-lipped peccary. And this white-lipped peccary, who has lived with them for generations, comes to them in their hunting rituals to feed them. So they actually see their grandmothers as contributing to their wellness by offering their bodies. And of course, the spirit can go into other entities, into jaguars, into enemies, into trees. Similarly, we read some stories about Malay cosmology and the value of tigers. One story says that a man died and turned into a member of a tiger band. But when night came, he went to visit his home, and he found one of his grandchildren. He was able to assume a human shape, which shape-shifting is often part of these encounters. Eventually, the boy followed him and was transported on the back of his grandfather. The boy then was able to see the brotherhood of tigers. And the story tells us that tigers were praying. The tigers were reading the Quran. They were learning and practicing the art of fencing, cooking, and singing. Eventually, his grandfather took him home. He regained his previous way of engaging the material world, but he was able to give this account of his grandfather, of the trip he took to the abode of the spirit tigers. So again, we see this movement across different spaces that help us to understand the animals. So the tigers, who are very scary, can also be part of sacred encounters. All of these stories model a different type of relationship, a different type of reality among human and animals. And I don't question them. I don't say, like the anthropologist, is the fish really singing? I don't ask, did the boy really go with his grandfather? Because to me, that's not the important question here. We also read an article about crocodiles, which explained how at one time they were understood as divine, even though they've become dangerous, scary, even troublesome in certain societies. But again, in the Malay world, there was an idea that crocodiles would not arbitrarily attack someone. Rather, there was a sense that they could tell what needed to be punished. They knew the people, they knew the community, and they would act accordingly. Similar to Miko's growl, there's a sense of responsibility on humans, and not full blame cast on the animals. The animals aren't fundamentally dangerous, but they are agents. They have power. They have abilities to engage with the human world as equals, if not as divine, as being above humans. And Viviers de Castro admits that in this cosmos that is full of humans, with their own perspectives, their own natures, multinaturalism is what he calls it, he admits that some of these other humans, these animals, are truly better than we are as humans. And in some sense, that's why our relationships are ruptured. The ritual specialists help to hear from the jaguar people, to hear from the peccary people, to try to then create balance. And as I was doing more research on the Amazon, the lowlands of South America, there were so many accounts about the rivers that were the center of creation, that carry spirits that are powerful and important to all of our survival. And yet there's mining, there's encroachment. The government isn't honoring the lands or the sovereignty or the wisdom of the indigenous peoples. It's a story we're all too familiar with. And that contemporary story shows what happens when we get out of relationships, when we act as though we do not have relationships with animal and plant and spirits. It's a reason we need to listen and learn from indigenous peoples who have maintained very powerful ways of communicating and caring for the earth. And that's not romanticizing. It's not to say that any of these communities have all the answers, because that universalizing, hegemonic way of thinking is part of the problem. But in locality, connected to different places, as Brian Burkhart, a Cherokee philosopher, says, we can learn from the coyote, but that has to come from epistemic locality, which is a fancy way of saying thinking from the land. His work of indigenizing philosophy is a way that non-native people in the US and beyond, like myself, can honor the knowledge of those who have been oppressed. Another story I'll bring from my class, Animals and the Unseen, is a fascinating debate in which animals go on trial against humans, and they're debating the Quran. In this story, the animals, they are forced into service, they are loaded down with burdens, and so they appear before the king. The king asks, what has brought you here? Why did you come to this land? The human says, these cattle, beasts of prey, and wild creatures, all animals, in fact, are our slaves. We are their masters. Some have rebelled and escaped. Others obey grudgingly but scorn our service. The king asks for evidence, and the human says that they have both religious and rational arguments. They turn to the Quran, in which they argue that the animals were created for their sake, that they should be slaves, and that the humans are their masters. Then the king says to the animals, cattle and beasts, you've heard the Quranic verses the human has adduced to support his claims. What say you to this? So a mule, which is the best that a mule would speak, rises up to say, speaking of creation and the work that God has done, that the earth was given to living beings, to animals and to plants. And after they were created were the jinn, the spirits. And then man were allowed to dwell in it, not to lay waste, but to care for the animals, not to abuse or mistreat them. The mule says, there's nothing here to support the claim that they are our masters. They talk about fleeing to the deserts as the humans are pursuing them, hunting them. And they say that those who fell into the hands of the humans were caged. They were slaughtered. And this story is beautiful because it shows the engagement of human and animals, of course still within a human context and a human court. but the animals are articulating their complaints. What would they say if we were listening now? What would Miko say? It makes me nervous. Okay, there's only one other example I want to give because there's just so much here. But this is actually from my professor, Taryn Savea, who's an excellent scholar of Islam and Muslim societies in South and Southeast Asia. He's not only an excellent scholar, but a wonderful professor and facilitator who enacts the very values that inspire me to teach someday as well. That being said, some of his research that he shared with us and the class loved, which I say because he's always trying to get out of sharing his research, was an example of a spirit embodying a tree at the site of a sacred shrine. This shrine was in one of the oldest harbors of Singapore. And this is about miracle workers. And these miracle workers are individuals, but also shrines. So the spirits both embody humans and also places. In one case, which Professor Savea writes about, a miracle occurred in the burial ground in which this important shrine would have been destroyed for urban redevelopment. But the spirits and the spirit mediums guarded her grave to the point that they were facing down the bulldozers. At one point, this powerful tree broke the bulldozers, and the eyewitnesses and the newspaper articles recorded that this tree would bleed. And from the tree, supernatural spirits would emerge. And the men who were sent to cut the tree were often injured. But the miracle workers, the caretakers, were kind, and they knew it wasn't the laborers' fault. So they worked to heal the laborers. Eventually, the spirit mediums, the specialists, were able to negotiate. And so in this act of resistance, there was also creativity and care, concrete manifestations of the unseen. And these negotiations are important. Back in the Amazon, the tapirs and the jaguars abduct Wari people, and often a shaman has to step in to negotiate. And in an Aztec example, when a tree needs to be cut for ceremony, there must be a process of granting permission. Otherwise, the tree can fall on you. And in the Nahua peoples today, descendants of the Aztecs, there are still practices of asking for permission. Indigenous communities around the world offer tobacco, cedar, incense, food. There's always reciprocity. There is always care. At a minimum, oftentimes it's more like respect, sometimes fear, definitely awe. And so I ask myself, what kind of offerings am I giving? How can I continue to be in a ritual relationship, in a reciprocal relationship with the beings around me? At a certain point in my 20s, I tried to pay more attention to animals, to insects. In some sense, I kind of felt like a kid again, like I was noticing the ants, watching the bees, trying not to kill the spiders. And there's something very magical about that. I learned a lot about stepping back, about being enchanted. But as I've shared through my experiences with Miko, and also through studying indigenous communities and animals, death and killing, consuming is always happening. I think about all the bugs and bacteria and critters inside and on my body, but we're in constant contact even when we don't realize it. But we've been socialized, just as we're socialized not to hear the fish singing. And I think one of the things that has become so important to me is the questioning of our foundation of ethics in the first place. And what I really love about some of the Mesoamerican and Amazonian ideas that I've been learning about is this idea that death and consumption and that killing can be done in beautiful ways. Because if we cannot accept death, if we cannot accept that we're constantly eating and being eaten, we're definitely not going to find better ways to do those things. It seems to me that the closer we are, the deeper we are in relationship, the better we will be at killing and consuming. And in that spirit, I'm returning to the topic of Miko. And I know it feels really wild to say, but I imagine that someday I'll be part of killing Miko. I hope it's more like the natural causes that we seem to prioritize, but I imagine I'll be helping him die. And I hope that can be in a ritual way. I hope it can be as a doula. And I certainly do not intend for that to happen anytime soon. Definitely not under the auspices of behavioral euthanasia. Largely due to Michael's commitment to Miko, his own sacrifices. In the next 4 or so years, Michael and I will probably sign the papers at the vet, like we did for Francie. They say dogs like Miko are prone to shorter lifespans, which is interesting because they say that about my Mexican family and other marginalized populations. Certainly, all of those who are deemed dangerous or deviant. And I hope if Miko's death comes before mine, that we can practice this perspectival way of compassionate killing. Like Francie, the squirrels, the peccaries, and me, Miko will shed his body, a body with no less value for being animal. And I hope to continue to learn from all of these examples, to care for the living and for the dead, to ensure that Miko is well-fed now and is well-fed as an ancestor. And if I'm lucky enough to perceive it, if this will be part of our story, maybe he will return the favor and visit me with gifts of his own. I do feel these emerging patterns. I'm leaning into the loom, a backbone built on perspectival, compassionate, grounded relationality. And my questions remain open. And I am committed to the deconstruction of these settler colonial ontologies that are based on domination, control, subjugation, hegemonic systems of power. This topic is urgent. As I've mentioned, there's crisis, ecological, interpersonal, conflicts among species. Death is happening everywhere and far too often without the care that our bodies and our spirits deserve and need. So as we enact to the best of our ability these indigenous and decolonial ways of relating to plants, animals, spirits, and beyond, I hope we can be good humans in the lands that we live upon, that we can translate across conflict and difference, and we can see the world with different eyes. And taking all of these teachings seriously, I went to offer a New England IPA to the earth, where I buried the squirrel. I paid attention to the hawks and to the hedgehogs, and I continued to invite them to aid me and guide me in becoming a better being in this body. I continue consuming my meals, dreaming my dreams, tending my altar, and witnessing as Miko and Rumi and my loved ones do the same. So I'll be here, and I'll be listening. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so grateful, Michael, for all the ways that you've taken care of Miko, the ways that you advocated for him, especially when I was most traumatized and scared. I'm so thankful that Miko has a human that is such a good caretaker. Sacrifice and your commitment to him is really beautiful and really brave and extremely honorable. Oh, oh.